Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Okay, good evening, everyone. Okay, today we will take a sutta called the Samagama Sutta. This is discourse number 104 in the Middle Length Discourses. And the sutta is named very simply after the name of the place, the village where it was spoken. And this village is situated in the Sakyan country, that is, it's the Buddha's own native land. And the sutta probably takes place fairly close to the end of the Buddha's life, because the sutta speaks or begins with a report about the death of Nigantha Nataputta, who was a somewhat older contemporary of the Buddha. And we see the Buddha laying down certain principles for the guidance of the Sangha, anticipating the time when he will no longer be in this world. Okay, so the sutta begins shortly after the death of Nigantha Nataputta. Who was Nigantha Nataputta, or the person referred to by the name Nigantha Nataputta? He's better known outside the Buddhist texts by the name Mahavira. And also he's known by the title Vajina, which means the conqueror, the victorious one. In his own, amongst his own following, that's what he is known as. And from the word Jina, one gets the word Jaina, or sometimes the A is dropped, so we get the word Jain. So Nigantha Nataputta is the person who's not actually the founder of Jainism, because Jainism, what's called Jainism, was a very old religion which probably went back perhaps several, in its origins, several centuries before the arising of Buddhism. And the Jains themselves speak about 24 great teachers in their lineage, and they call their teachers by the word Tirthankara. The word Tirtha means a ford. That's a place for crossing a river. And Tirthankara means the maker of a ford, one who creates a ford. And this idea of crossing a river is used in Buddhism and in other Indian spiritual systems to represent the idea of crossing the stream of samsara in order to achieve liberation. And so the Tirthankaras are, for the Jains, the great teachers who create the system of spiritual philosophy and of practice as a means of crossing over from this dakshore of birth, old age, and death to the far shore of liberation. And according to the Jains themselves, Mahavira was the 24th Tirthankara in our historical period. And his predecessor was named Parshva. That was the 23rd Tirthankara. Who is said to have lived in the 9th and 8th centuries BC. So if we have the Buddha teaching in the 5th century BC, then Parshva would have been 3 or 4 centuries before the Buddha. And one thing that one notices when one reads the Buddha suttas, you see that contemporary with the Buddha, there was the religion of the Brahmins, which we call Brahmanism. And then there are a number of sects or schools of spiritual practice that fall outside the scope of Brahmanism. What characterizes Brahmanism is in some way a belief in the Vedas as being the sacred texts from which all spiritual philosophies and systems of practice have to recognize as authoritative. And then those schools of Indian philosophy which do not accept the authority of the Vedas, which are considered heterodox, these lie outside the scope of Brahmanism. And they had quite a different attitude towards life, quite a different philosophy from the Brahmins. Now what one notices in the Buddhist texts is that the Buddha is critical of some of the important ideas of Brahmanism. The idea of sacrifice, the sacrifice of animals. Since the Buddha teaches that one should practice compassion towards all living beings. And that means that one doesn't kill them, one doesn't take their lives. And whereas the Brahmins did not look favorably upon the idea of renunciation and monasticism, of course the Buddha established a monastic order. The Buddha also rejected the Brahminic idea of the class system, a fixed class system. Though the system during the Buddha's time had not yet turned into what we call the caste system, which arose probably gradually over the course of several centuries after the time of the Buddha. But nevertheless, when the Buddha speaks about the Brahmins, he's usually quite gentle in speaking about them, and regularly he enters into conversations with the Brahmins, and the discussion is usually quite courteous and cordial. In contrast, when the Buddhist texts speak about the Jains, one could see that they speak about them often in a quite denigrating, derogatory way. We see an instance of this here. Okay, the text reports that after the death of Nigantha Nataputta, or Mahavira, his followers were called Nigantas. The word Nigantha means the ones who are without any bonds, without any knots, the ones who have untied the knots. So the Nigantas divided, split into two, and they were quarreling, brawling, and they were deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers. And each side was saying that, you don't understand this teaching, we understand this teaching, and so on. There's a stock passage here, which is used again and again in the suttas when describing disputes. And then the text goes on to say, it seemed as if there were nothing but slaughter among the Nigantha Nataputta's pupils. And then his lay disciples become disgusted and disappointed because they say that what Nigantha Nataputta was teaching was a badly proclaimed and badly expounded Dharma and discipline, which is unemancipating, unconducive to peace, expounded by one not fully enlightened, and which was now with its shrine broken. The shrine was the living figure of Nigantha Nataputta. And so when he dies, it's like the shrine has broken. And now they're left without a refuge. So you could see how the text is very sharp, very harshly critical of the Jains. But now we have to give, let's say that history is written from the standpoint of those who are adopting a particular perspective to view history. And so this account of the Jains makes it seem as if the Jains, as soon as their leader, Mahavira, passed away, had split and were engaged in bitter fights, and as though the Jain religion is just going to come to a quick end. In point of fact, the Jain religion survived in India longer than Buddhism did. And the Jains later divided into two main sects, two main schools. But this happened about 200 years after the passing away of Mahavira. So it couldn't be this division that's being referred to in the text here. The two main divisions of the Jains were, one is called the Svetambara and the other Digambara. Okay, the Svetambara, the word umbara means clothing or covering. And the Svetambara, the word Sveta means white. So the Svetambara are Jains who wear white robes. The Digambara, the word dig here means the directions, the different quarters. And Digambara means those who have the different directions as their clothing. And this means that they don't wear, in fact, they don't wear any clothing. They have the space of the four directions as their clothing. So they go about completely naked. I think they might be allowed to use a covering, some kind of covering during the cold season. Because it can be quite cold in northern India. But when I visited India to make the Buddhist pilgrimage in 1975, when I was visiting the city of Rajagaha, there was a big festival or religious convocation of the Jains at that time. And naked Jain ascetics from the Digambara sect had all congregated into this either a temple or a monastery in Rajagaha. So I went along with some Thai monks to participate in that ceremony. We were standing on the outside with the Jain lay people. But this would have been in early November, and it was quite cold, and if I remember, I had to wear a sweater, and the Thai monks also were wearing sweaters. But the Jain ascetics, just not wearing anything. Okay, so there's this division that took place in the Jains about 200 years after the time of the Buddha. But from what I understand, I don't know all that much about Jainism, but from what I've read, is that the differences between them revolve just upon a few minor points of discipline. According to, of course, one of the most obvious is the question whether a Jain ascetic is allowed to wear some kind of clothing or covering. The Digambaras, the naked ascetics, say no. A true ascetic has to give up attachment to every type of article, every type of possession, including clothes. Whereas the Swetambaras say that one can possess a white robe as a covering. But apart from that, it seems on basic points of doctrine, the two schools are in quite close agreement. Now again, I'm not trying to be a defendant of Jainism against Buddhism, but one looks at the history of Buddhism and one sees within 200 years of the passing of the Buddha, Buddhism is divided into about 18 schools, differing on quite fundamental points of doctrine. A few hundred years later, there's another division. Mahayana Buddhism emerges, criticizing the early forms of Buddhism. Then later, a few hundred years later, Vajrayana, Tantric Buddhism, arises and criticizes even conventional Mahayana Buddhism, as well as, by that time, the early schools are almost forgotten. And then by the 12th century, Buddhism virtually disappears from India, whereas the Jains continue on and still exist in India today. They don't have a large percentage of followers. I think perhaps they're about 1% of the Indian population. But they form quite prominent communities in certain parts of India. Particularly, they're quite numerous in Gujarat, some in Maharashtra, I think. And Jain lay people are quite successful in business, so many of the important businesses are owned by Jains. But if we ask, what are the reason why Buddhism became so critical of Jainism, whereas it wasn't so harshly critical of Brahmanism itself, though they rejected, the Buddhists of course rejected some ideas of Brahmanism. One finds there's a saying that close cousins tend to get into more quarrels than people who are somewhat distant neighbors. Okay, some of the terms quite familiar in Buddhism. The idea of karma, shared by Jainism and Buddhism. the Jains had the idea of karma before the arising of Buddhism. The term asava, which is used in Buddhism for the taints or the basic defilements, we also have the same word in Jainism. The idea that living beings are in bondage to the cycle of samsara, the cycle of birth and death, and the aim is to gain moksha, or liberation, is common to the same systems, is common to the two systems, Buddhism and Jainism. The rejection of belief in a creator God, a God who rules the universe, this is common to both Buddhism and Jainism. The idea that the world is full of suffering and that the goal of the religious life is to gain liberation from suffering is common to the two systems. A point on which they differ is over the belief in a self. The Jains accept the idea of a permanent individual soul, and they hold that the soul is in bondage to conditioned existence, to matter, and that through spiritual practice one aims to liberate the soul from the bondage of material existence. And when the soul is liberated, then it goes into a transcendent realm and remains ever free, ever blissful, all-knowing, all-seeing. Whereas the Buddha does not accept the idea of a permanent soul or self. And then in regard to spiritual practice, there's an important difference that the Jains emphasize asceticism, strict asceticism. They hold that the way to eliminate one's karma and to purify the soul is by the practice of self-mortification. By doing that, one wears away one's old karma until when it's all worn away, then the soul is liberated. And so the Jains used two concepts to designate distinct practices or stages of spiritual practice. One is called sangvara, which means restraint. And it's by restraint, restraining the senses, restraining oneself from unnecessary actions, that one stops the accumulation of more karma. And then the practice called nijara. Nijara means wearing away, wearing out. And so by ascetic practices, one wears away the old karma. And then when all the old karma is worn away, one is liberated. Now we find the Buddha takes both of these terms and absorbs them into his own system of training. He uses the word sangvara to mean restraint of the senses. And by restraining the senses, then one protects the mind from the arising and strengthening of defilements. And then he uses the word nijara, wearing away, with reference to the wearing away of greed, hatred, and delusion. And so when greed, hatred, and delusion are completely worn away, then that is liberation. That is nibbana, nirvana in this very life. And so we can see that Buddhism did not develop in a vacuum, but it grew up within a particular milieu of concepts and practices that were current amongst the spiritual seekers of the period. And it absorbed and took over quite a number of these terms and ideas. But whatever terms and ideas the Buddha took, he imparted his own unique meanings to them, and gave them a sense which would be congruent with that of his own spiritual system. Okay, so now, coming back to our sutta, the Nigantha Nataputta, that is Mahavira, had passed away at a town named Pava. Pava is close to Kusinara. It's very close to the place. Interesting. It's very close to the place where the Buddha passed away. I think it's just on the other side of a little river. And so at this time, a novice named Chunda had spent the rains retreat at the town of Pava, and he would have heard that the great teacher of the Jains, Mahavira, has passed away. Then he would have come to Samagama after the rains and reported this to Venerable Ananda, the Buddha's attendant. And then the Venerable Ananda realized that this was quite an important event, and he said we should go to the Buddha and report this to him. Interestingly, in the suttas, we never see the Buddha and Mahavira meet and hold a discussion. But in a few suttas, the Buddha himself approaches Jain ascetics and has discussions with them. Okay, so now Chunda and Ananda go to the Buddha and report to him that Mahavira has just died, and now his following has divided into two, and they're immersed in this conflict and disputes. And then Ananda says, I hope that when you are gone, the Blessed One, when you, the Blessed One, are gone, that no dispute will arise in the Sangha. For such a dispute would be for the harm and unhappiness of many people, for the loss, harm, and suffering of the devas and human beings. Okay, now the Buddha is going to disclose what are the central pillars of his teaching that should be preserved in order for his teaching to survive in the world. He says, these things that I have taught to you after directly knowing them, that is the four foundations of mindfulness, the four right efforts or four kinds of striving, the four bases for spiritual power, the five faculties, the five powers, the seven enlightenment factors, and the Noble Eightfold Path. Do you see even two monks making different assertions about these things? Then Ananda says, I don't see even two monks who are explaining these things differently. But then Ananda says, but there are people who are now living deferential or respectful towards the Buddha. But after the Buddha has gone, after he's passed away, these people might create a dispute in the Sangha about the way of living, livelihood, and about the Patimokkha. The Patimokkha is the collection of the rules of monastic discipline. Then Ananda says, such a dispute would be for the harm and unhappiness of many, for the loss, harm, and suffering of gods and human beings. So Ananda is concerned about what is called livelihood, the monk's way of life, details of the monk's way of life, and about the code of 220 or so rules of discipline. But now the Buddha says something quite interesting. He says, a dispute about livelihood. This is about the monastic way of life, the details of the monastic way of life. Or a dispute about the rules of discipline would be trifling, something not very significant. The Pali word here is appamattiko, something which is quite small or trifling. But the Buddha says, if a dispute arises in the Sangha about the path or the way, the path or the practice, that dispute would be for the harm and unhappiness of many, for the loss, harm, and suffering of gods and humans. So the Buddha is pointing to the importance of preserving what is called the path or the practice. And this path or practice is what is laid out, what is disclosed in the sets of factors that he enumerated a few paragraphs earlier. That is, it's the four foundations of mindfulness, and so on through the Noble Eightfold Path. A short time after the passing away of the Buddha, these different groups of factors came to be designated the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas, the 37 factors that are aids to enlightenment, the factors that are on the side of enlightenment. And in another sutta that occurs in the Digha Nikaya, it's called the Pasadika Sutta, the Buddha, when he's addressing the whole Sangha, he says that after I have passed away, you should meet often and you should repeat, recite, as well as practice these things that I have taught you through direct knowledge. And he mentions the same sets, the four foundations of mindfulness, the four right kinds of striving, etc., to the Noble Eightfold Path. So those are the constituents or building blocks of the path or way that the Buddha taught. And those are the things that he emphasizes should be, have to be preserved in the world in order for the Dharma to flourish. And then the Buddha goes on to mention the types of psychological attitudes that give rise to disputes. Here he's not so much talking about the subject matter over which a dispute can arise, but when disputes arise, they usually arise through certain psychological factors, factors of the mind. And he calls these six roots of disputes, but actually if you look at them, you see that there are more than six factors here. But he groups pairs of them into one, under one heading. And so we actually have 11 roots of disputes. Okay, the first is the two factors. Here it's translated angry and resentful. But I'm not sure that resentful is a good translation. It's anger, and upanaha means something like malice or hostility. This happens, you see, anger is something which arises briefly and then it can subside. But what happens when one becomes repeatedly angry towards a particular person? Then that anger turns into, yeah, we can call it resentment or hostility or a feeling of malice towards that person. Okay, the second root of dispute is called... Okay, then the Buddha says, coming back to the first root of disputes, he says, such a monk who's angry and resentful then becomes disrespectful and without deference, without... say, without humility towards the Buddha, towards the Dhamma, and towards the Sangha. And because of that anger and resentment or malice, he does not fulfill the training. And then when he's not fulfilling the training, not practicing these 37 aids to enlightenment, then he becomes inclined to find some way to quarrel with the other monks who are engaged in the practice. And so then he starts a dispute. Usually the origin of dispute is not so much based on the content, but on the attitude in the mind. So if in one's mind one has this anger and resentment, then one starts looking for a pretext to start a dispute. And then one will seize on the content and make a dispute over that. Okay, the second... well, still on the first one. Then the Buddha says that when the monk dwells disrespectful towards the teacher, Dhamma, and Sangha, and creates a dispute in the Sangha, then that dispute will be for the harm and unhappiness of many, for the loss, harm, and suffering of gods and humans. Then he says, if you see any such root of dispute, either in yourselves or externally... what does externally mean here? It doesn't mean in things like trees, rocks, or buildings, but it means if you see other people, especially other monks who are tending to become angry and resentful, then you should strive to abandon or to overcome that root of dispute. If you see it in yourself, you should make an effort to overcome this anger and resentment. If you see it in others, then you have to try to find some way to talk to them and to help them to overcome that tendency to provoke disputes. And so you have to make the effort to abandon the root of dispute whenever it arises, and then you should practice in such a way that this root of disputes does not erupt, does not arise in the future. In other words, one has to try to completely abandon it within oneself and also to eliminate it in others. Okay, the other roots of dispute. One is, the second here is translated contemptuous, or contempt and insolence. But actually the word mukha means more denigration of others. So when others have good qualities, one doesn't recognize them, but instead one smears their character by slandering them. And palasa, the way palasa is explained, the way I understand it, it means that one displays a kind of arrogance towards others. One insults them and tries to dominate others and to control them. Okay, the third root of dispute, here it's translated envious and avaricious. But it's better envy and miserliness. Through envy, when others have good qualities, or spiritual accomplishment, or when they gain honor and renown, instead of rejoicing and feeling a kind of altruistic joy in their success, one experiences resentment towards them. And then what's called macheria is miserliness. It means that one doesn't want to share one's possessions with others, doesn't want to share teachings with others, but one tries to keep for oneself. The Buddha mentions five types of miserliness that one encounters in the monastic life. That is miserliness regarding dwellings. If one has dwellings, one doesn't want to accommodate others in them. Sometimes a monk will have a big temple, but doesn't want to allow others to come to live in his temple. There's miserliness regarding families or supporters. So when one has a number of supporters, one tries to keep them to oneself, isn't willing to introduce other monks to them, because one is afraid that those other monks will steal one's supporters. Then there's miserliness regarding one's gains, whatever offerings one is given. One doesn't share them with others. Then there's miserliness with praise. That is, one doesn't want to praise others in front of a group. That's because one is envious of the good qualities of others. And so that leads to a kind of miserliness. One doesn't want to praise others. And then there's miserliness regarding Dhamma. That means one doesn't want to teach others. Because if one teaches others, then one is afraid that they will become knowledgeable as well. And so they will have the opportunity to shine. Okay, the fourth root of dispute is called deceitfulness and fraudulence. Deceitfulness is explained as displaying virtues that one does not have. And fraudulence means hiding or covering up faults that one does have. This is the way the two terms are explained in the Pali commentaries. But I saw a Sanskrit commentary by a Sangha. I think it's called the Abhidharma Samuchaya. A Sangha was a great commentator of the Mahayana Yogacara school. And he explained the two terms in the opposite way. He explained deceitfulness as covering up one's faults and fraudulence as displaying virtues that one doesn't really have. So it seems in different schools of Buddhism, the two terms were interpreted in the opposite ways. Okay, the fifth root of dispute is what's called evil wishes. That's a wish for wealth, fame, prominence, power, position. And so somebody who has evil wishes will be inclined to provoke disputes so that he can get more power, higher position. And then evil wishes goes along with wrong view. When one has a wrong view, it's a serious wrong understanding of the Dhamma, then one will be inclined to misinterpret the Dhamma and thereby start a dispute with others. And then the sixth root of dispute is called adhering to one's own views, one's own opinions, holding on to them tenaciously and relinquishing them with difficulty, not being willing to relinquish one's own views, one's own opinions. I think this is a very natural tendency in the human mind. One sees when people have a discussion, sometimes it turns out they'll have a different opinion about some subject. And instead of trying to come to a correct understanding of the subject, each person holds on to their own opinion and tries to argue the other person down until the other person will say, "I give up," and then give up his opinion. But if the two of them cling to their own views, then you get a very bitter dispute which will lead to division. Okay, so in relation to these six types of dispute, or six roots of dispute, the Buddha makes the same statement that you should, if you see any of these within yourself, try to root it out from within yourself. If you see it externally in others, try to help the others to eliminate that root of dispute. And train in such a way that these roots of dispute will not arise and that they'll be completely abandoned in the future. Okay, I said I wasn't going to cover these intermediate sections which deal with some details of monastic discipline. If you want, you could read them, but I won't explain them. But I want to go over to the end of the sutta. where the Buddha speaks about six principles, what are called the six principles of cordiality. These are sometimes also called the six principles of harmony. I think in Chinese you have them as Liu He Fa. Dui Bu Dui? Jing. Liu Jing Fa. Liu He Jing Fa. Six principles of harmony and respect. Liu He Jing Fa. So the Buddha says that these six principles create love or affection and respect, and they lead to cohesion, to non-disputes. They're the antidote for disputes, and they lead to concord or harmony and unity. Okay, so what are these six? One, and these six principles, though the Buddha is teaching them to the Sangha, to the monastic order, but they are also applicable in everyday life. So in any kind of group or organization to which you belong, you can apply these six principles of harmony. Okay, here the Buddha says, a monk maintains bodily acts of loving kindness, whether in public or in private, towards his companions in the spiritual life. And so one will do things physically that will be beneficial to others. For example, if somebody is sick, then one might call a doctor, clean up their room for them, prepare medicine for them. If somebody needs some item, one will lend them something that they need. There are many different ways of physically showing kindness to others, and the act should be accompanied, of course, by loving kindness in the mind. And through these bodily acts of loving kindness, then they create love and harmony, affection and harmony. Okay, the second principle it's called verbal acts of loving kindness. That is, you speak about others in a way that points out their good qualities, praises their good qualities. One speaks to others gently. One speaks with kindness to others. And one tries to avoid speaking bad things about others, criticizing them behind their backs, slandering them to others. But whenever one has to speak about another person, always try to speak in a good way, a way that highlights their good qualities. But if you have to speak critically about another, sometimes it's necessary, but one should try to do so without feelings of malice or malevolence in one's mind. And if one has to criticize others, of course one should do so, the Buddha says. But when one speaks to others critically, one has to do so with the intention of helping them, of benefiting them. And one should speak at the right time, not at the wrong time. For example, if you're going to criticize somebody, you don't come in when they're accompanied by their friends and then start criticizing them, because that will embarrass them, humiliate them in front of their friends. But if you want to talk to somebody, to point out their faults, you find a time when they have leisure, and then speak to them privately about their faults. Okay, the third principle, which really lies behind the first two, is to have mental acts of loving kindness towards others. That is, one sets up, establishes a mind intent on benefiting others, on helping them, and wishes for their well-being and happiness. Okay, then the fourth principle the Buddha points out is sharing one's possessions with others. And this is especially important for monks, since all of the things we receive are not things that we've worked for through our hard labor, but they're things that people offer to us. And in the Sangha, the monastic order, ideally there are not private possessions, but it's a kind of, we could say it's almost a kind of communism. Everything should be possessed in common by all members of the community. And so one shares any gains that one acquires with others. And even in the days when the monks go on alms round, when they accumulate food that's offered in their alms bowl, when they come back to the monastery, they will share what they get with others. Sometimes what is done is to put out big bowls on the table, and then when each monk comes back, he'll empty his bowl and put all of the food that he's gotten into these big bowls. And so then all of the monks can come and take whatever food they want. So it's not like, I've gotten a lot, somebody else has gotten a little, and so I eat my full bowl, while the person who gets a little has to go hungry. But everything is put out, and each one takes what he needs. Isn't that what, was it Engels who said? From each according to his ability and to each according to his needs. Okay, and then the Buddha says, the fifth principle is one observes in common with one's fellow monks those virtues that are unbroken, untorn, unblotched, unmodeled, liberating, commended by the wise, not clung to, and which are conducive to samadhi, to meditative tranquility. And so when the monks have the precepts, they all observe the same precepts, not the case that a few observe the precepts and then others just break them. When others break the precepts, then it creates disharmony, conflict, resentment. Okay, and then the sixth principle of harmony and respect is possessing in common with one's fellows in the spiritual life the same view, having the same perspective, the same outlook. And this is the perspective of the Buddha's teaching, what is called samaditti, or right view. And the Buddha calls this the view that is noble and emancipating and leads, when one practices in accordance with it, leads to the complete destruction of suffering. So that is the essential unifying factor in the Buddhist community, is sharing together the views of the Dhamma. Okay, and then the Buddha ends by telling Ananda that he and all of the monks should undertake and maintain these six principles of cordiality, or six principles of harmony and respect. Okay, I'll let this be the presentation for tonight. If there's any questions, then please feel welcome to ask.
It's kind of tangential, but what do you think accounted for the sort of demise of Buddhism in India?
It's a pretty big... First, I think a lot of the principles of Buddhism had been absorbed into what we now call Hinduism. So Hinduism took a lot of principles from Buddhism and absorbed it into itself. So the differences between Hinduism and Buddhism were becoming less... the differences were becoming less prominent. Also, the Buddhists tended to become, this I think was an important factor, concentrated in large monasteries and monastic universities, which were subsidized by the kings, by the rajas, the maharajas. And so I think that they became less dependent upon support from the lay community, because they would have been subsidized by kings or by wealthy merchants. They had all of their needs presented to them. And so they interacted less with the people. And in this way, to fulfill the religious needs of the people, Hinduism was able to move in. Whereas I think the Jains probably kept up their ascetic way of life more consistently than the Buddhists did. And then the factor that dealt the death blow to Buddhism in India was the invasion of the Muslim hordes. This was in the 11th and 12th centuries. And they found all of the Buddhas concentrated in these large monasteries and monastic universities. And so they could just wipe them out. I think the Jains, by that time, had moved, settled in places like Gujarat and maybe South India, so that they were not vulnerable to the attacks of the Muslim hordes, whereas the Buddhists were concentrated in northern India. Okay, there were some other... I thought I saw a few hands up. Okay, if there's no questions, then we conclude for tonight. Okay, the next class we have will be on, this is Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 108. This is called the Gopika Moggallana Sutta. And this sutta takes place after the Buddha has passed away. So this gives us some perspective on the way the Sangha, newly orphaned, having lost its leader, how it conducted its affairs. Okay, we end with the sharing of the merits. The next class will be, I didn't mention the date, December 11th. If we're snowed out, then we'll have to make it the 18th. I have a doctor's appointment that early afternoon, but could go later. Okay, we share the merits with the devas, nagas, and other beings. Akasa ta chabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasa ta chabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasa ta chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Eta vatacha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabasampati siddhya. Eta vatacha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu.